the commonality of crossing party lines for different bills. And back during the Reagan era, it certainly wasn't ever 50-50, but it was people willing to cross the aisle a lot more. And today it's just gone further and further and further apart.
We each have our own gift to give, and yours is unique. Welcome to the Calvin Carrelli Show. I'm really excited to have you. All right, welcome everybody. I'm Calvin Carrelli. I'm here with Doug Sutton. Doug and I met in Encinitas some, like, I don't know, 8 years ago or something like that, and hung out and had a good time. We haven't actually met since, but now we are here talking politics. We've never talked politics before. I posted on my Facebook, like, hey, any Biden voters out there that are courageous enough to jump on and have a conversation with me about why, so I can understand it. And Doug volunteered. I'm super, super grateful that you did. Thanks for doing it. Welcome.
My pleasure. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah. So Doug, tell us a little bit about what you do today, who you are, just so we have a sense.
I do business consulting. I've had the pleasure and honor of working with a number of great consulting firms over the years, primarily in the area of business growth strategy and profit optimization. I grew up on a farm in Illinois, and from there transitioned into the real estate industry when I was 20 years old, and had a number of mentors in that space. And I had become a CEO for one of the largest franchises in Arizona. And from there started working with some personal development leaders and high-end consulting companies. And I've had my own boutique consulting company since 2012. So basically, I like to look at it like being the CSI detective, where I go into a company and assess what's going on, right? So look at the culture, the story, the messaging, and be really a detective to figure out, like, hey, there's a crime and they want me to solve it. So what is the crime? It's that they're not producing results that they want, and I got to figure out why. So picking up the stones, yeah. Asking questions, holding a place of neutrality, and
nice. There, I like that.
Integrating things, yeah. So that's right.
There's a crime, which is people aren't buying this product and they're not aware of it. That's a crime against humanity, because this is amazing. I like that. And your company's name is Conscious Growth. Is that correct?
Right. That's exactly
right. I love that. That's amazing.
Well,
that's
so good. one of the perspectives I have, and it's relevant to the times that we're in on a political level as well, is that I believe that unconscious growth causes unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. And there are actions that people take that they're not consciously aware of in their mind. They're being more reactive based upon the stimuli that they're being presented with, or the deeply rooted patterns of behavior that they have, or belief systems that they're carrying on, or whoever they're listening to in the news or the media, and based upon that, take an action. And so the word conscious just is the same word as aware. They're interchangeable words. So how can we invite people to be conscious or aware of, wait a minute, why am I taking the action that I am? Is this really in alignment with my values? What will be the impact or the ripple effect of these words I'm about to say, or the actions I'm about to take, both now and into the future, for my life and the world around me? So that's more of, like, I guess, the philosophical approach. And it's my belief that when a company or an individual has that consideration of being aware or conscious of how their actions have a ripple effect, that they can set themselves up to avoid the unintended consequences, like eating certain foods and it feels great going down, but it's not really good on the body, or doing something for the environment that they're just not consciously aware, or even communicating within their business or with their loved ones that they're not aware of how their words impact the environment around them or their culture. So,
yeah, that's great. So, yeah, we just talked about, like, my political project is called Notable Nation, and I haven't shared that with you before. So you don't know, but it came out of this moment for me when in 2013, when I was living in India, and my wife asked me some questions for my birthday, some big life questions, like, you know, if you could do anything, what would you do or whatnot? And this sentence came to me fully formed. It was, I want to be a special advisor to the president of the United States on conscious nation building. So that was my sort of entry point into the world of politics. So I love that.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And my whole approach to business is the same. Like, spiritual entrepreneurship is the term that I've been using.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I love it. So, well, there's no coincidences. And just like accepting this conversation, I'm sure it will evolve to something beyond the reason why we thought we came here today.
Exactly.
Something beyond that. So,
yeah. All right. Phenomenal. So let's talk about your what's your history with politics? What's your background there? Where are you at?
Grew up in the Midwest on a farm, as I mentioned before, and very conservative part of the country. And I can say that a lot of those conservative values still stay very true to who I am today, especially, I guess, if we're looking at fiscal policy. And I grew up strong Republican. I was in the Young Republicans Club in college and was one of the leaders in my group, and did advocate outreach and campaigning for people within my local community. My first election when I was old enough to vote was George Bush Sr. So my voting history, just to be very clear, was Bush Sr., Ross Perot, because I loved the idea of an independent business person that was not a politician. And a lot of people thought I was crazy and that it was people like me that gave the election to Clinton, because I just didn't like Bob Dole and I loved Ross Perot. I was very passionate about politics at that time. Bush Jr., McCain, Romney, and Clinton. Mm. So I bet you very few people have that exact history.
Yeah, no, that's interesting.
Yeah, it was a big chasm that I crossed in the last election.
Interesting. Yeah, I think Obama drew, I think, a lot of Republican voters, right?
I honestly don't know. And here's the thing for me, I guess, in previous elections, the moment Obama won, I was like, awesome, game on. Like, I actually wanted McCain. I voted for McCain. I voted for Romney. But it was like there was this willingness to, I can go with that. And had Gore won, I would have been just as okay and happy with that. Of course, I have different philosophical perspectives around certain policy positions. But, you know, at the end of the day, I looked at them as pretty decent human beings and people that I could, you know, accept as my president, even though I may not agree with them.
Right. So what happened? So Trump changed things, it sounds like.
Yeah.
He made you abandon the ticket.
You know, there's Emerson. I love studying philosophy, and Emerson's one of my favorite philosophers. And one of his sayings is that who you are speaks so loud, I can't hear what you're saying. There's a lot that Trump says that I don't agree with. From my observation and perspective, the who he is something that it's very difficult for me to support or get behind. Mm-hmm. And when I look at core values.
And what is the who he is? What are the qualities that you see there?
Yeah. So, and also from a consulting hat as well, if I was like hiring a leader within an organization or someone to be part of a culture of a company, that there is inherently a ripple effect or impact, like as I mentioned with conscious growth, that a person's personality or their psychological makeup impacts other people around them. And what I've observed, and when I first realized that I could not support Trump, and I loved the idea of a non-politician and an independent, just like I said, with Ross Perot, I was all about Perot. And part of me was hopeful. And even when I had the resistance around Trump, I was kind of like, not necessarily promised, but suggested that, hey, once he gets in office, he'll change. But there was this divisiveness and an energy of attacking anyone that did not agree with him, even people within his own party. I lived in Arizona, as I mentioned, for 10 years, and I loved John McCain and the way that he attacked John McCain and the things he said about him and or anyone. And we can set aside the partisan politics and set aside the people from the Democratic Party that he attacks and says things about, and just has this, what I've observed as a behavior that if someone disagrees with him, that there's an inability to receive negative feedback or constructive feedback, and instead this automated response to go on the attack and deflect or deny or turn it around on the other person. And so seeing the Republican primary, and literally it was like he bought JebBush.com. And so if you go to JebBush.com, it was a Donald Trump website. And you know what he did to Santorum, and the guy from Texas is escaping me, and you know, all the different people that were on that ticket, Marco Rubio, was just attack, 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 John Kasich, attack. It just feels like a vindictive, dishonest way of being. And I've seen that in organizations as well, where there may be a top salesperson or a very talented CEO candidate to come into a company to run an organization that has the skill set, they've got the background and the expertise and the knowledge, and maybe policy positions about how to run a company. But because of their psychological and emotional makeup, would be toxic to the culture of the company. And you can give a company the best strategy and tactics in the world, but if it is underlying a toxic culture or a leader that has that type of mentality, it can ruin the organization. And I had that fear that might be the makeup that would happen with Trump. And over the last 4 years, I really feel that it's only been validated, unfortunately, from my experience.
Got it. I think that is probably honestly the most valid criticism that I've heard of in, like, I'm not the ultimate arbiter of what's valid, right? But in my view, I think that is a very on point, very, very valid criticism. I will say, I don't know if he attacks people who disagree with him or attack people who attacks him. Cause that's what I see. What I've noticed the most is, like, if you attack him, he's going to sure shit attack you back. Right? Like, no question about that. He's a massive bully. Does he handle people who disagree with him, but aren't necessarily, like, if you undermine him, he'll attack you. Right? Like, but does he agree? Does he attack people who just disagree with him respectfully? Does that happen or no? I'm not sure. I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, I've felt that there was definitely that attacking tone from my perspective, especially during the primaries. And there's a level of name calling and just using elementary, just like childish type of names. And do you have any kids?
I do have kids, yeah.
Okay, cool. So, you know, and I've never had kids, so I've only seen this happen where you may hold a spoon for your child and then open your mouth like, ha, like that, and you put it in, and then the child mimics your behavior. And I think I see this in leadership positions where this is my biggest concern, Calvin. My biggest concern is that demeanor of the attacking, the mean-spiritedness. Even if someone attacks them, I think a great leader, especially people in leadership positions, can weather attacks. That's kind of what they do. And we can go back to Obama, to George W. Bush, to Bush Senior, to Clinton. Reagan wasn't attacked that much. A lot of people liked him, but even some people attacked him or said negative comments.
Yeah.
That there's a way of just being able to deflect that's a responsibility that a leader has. Mm-hmm. And I believe that the CEO of a company, the leader of a household or a family, and certainly the president of the United States sets the tone and an example for other people to follow. Right. And that's probably my biggest concern about the state of our political climate and this divisiveness that we see in our world today, that there is that the president of all people sets that tone and that standard of energy and demeanor of how to engage with someone that disagrees. So,
right. I completely agree. So my dream is for some president at some point, like a Nelson Mandela, right? Mm-hmm. Who's done the work, who's done his own inner work so that he can show up as that leader that stands very firm and unifies people. That's my dream leader at some point. Trump is not that guy, right?
Yeah.
there's no question about that. But it's you know, we only get to pick between two options in this election, right?
So, Absolutely.
Or I guess Kanye is also running, but, like, you know, of the two that actually have a chance of winning, there are only two of them. So yes, there's a lot of qualities that I wish, you know, Trump had, or that I wish he didn't have. And, you know, so you have to weigh what's more important to you, right? And where I'm coming from is what I see is a political class, like political system, Democrat versus Republicans. They fight on, pre-Trump, right? They've been arguing sort of on paper, but really behind the scenes, they've been all buddies and pals, and they have sold out the American people to the highest bidder for decades, right? the country, the middle class has been shrinking, income inequality has been growing. Like you, I come from Denmark, you know, you travel around America and it's like a third world freaking country, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
it's a mess. And I think that's by design, by corrupt politicians, corrupt in the sense that they need to raise so much funds to run their campaigns.
Yep.
Obviously they become beholden to you know, special interests and, you know, the media and the Silicon Valley work closely together with politicians. And then, you know, more recently, or I guess not even that recently, but China is a massive influence at every level, politically, at the federal level, state level, local level, universities, schools, et cetera, et cetera. That to me is the big defining thing. Right, the big defining. And so I will overlook some of Trump's flaws because I believe that he's the only one that's going to actually fight against that system.
That's a good perspective, and I can appreciate that. I certainly agree that the system that we've had is not working. I am not a fan of the two-party system. And I think it was John Adams, who was one of our founding fathers, said his greatest fear is that our country would be divided amongst two grand parties. And, you know, like he wrote this beautiful, like, transcript about that. And no question that corporations, different groups play a role in being the puppet master to what could be perceived as the puppets that are the politicians that we have in our world. And so to me, I can see how people would suggest that Trump represents that. I also perceive him to be someone who has his own interests most at heart. And, both with his own personal business dealings, lack of showing the transparency with his own tax returns, these are things that have bothered me. But then looking at people like the John Kellys of the world, and General Mattis that, you know, have been inside. They're not really politicians per se. Now we can say that the military is behind it too. And if we want to go down that rabbit hole, I'm not sure I'm prepared to have that conversation because that's a much deeper one. But, you know, going back to it, there's no question. There's a lot of things I don't agree with about Biden or about the Democratic platform as a whole. And I also aspire to have a Mandela type of person be our president someday. And I aspire to change the paradigm and the system of this two-party system that we have in our country, because I think it's only tearing us further and further apart. You can go back to Reagan and Tip O'Neill. They had a great relationship. And if you look at even votes in Congress, you've seen these maps maybe that show the divide or the commonality of crossing party lines for different bills. And back during the Reagan era, it certainly wasn't ever 50-50, but it was people willing to cross the aisle a lot more. And today it's just gone further and further and further apart. I believe the consciousness and the energy and the tone that Trump represents does not bring us closer together. It actually moves us further apart, even amongst people within his own party as well. So that's, I guess, one of my bigger concerns. And I do appreciate the perspective of getting out of this two-party politically corrupt system that we have.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's no question that he's divisive. I actually want to touch on the military thing. I'm sorry, but I think it's important to go there. You're of course familiar with the famous Eisenhower, right? Like military industrial complex.
Yep.
And my assessment is that military generals tend to, you know, rotate in and out of government or like from military to industry and make lots of money doing that. And they have an interest, like the more wars America is in, the better it is for them. And a lot of other people, media and everybody, like a lot of people profit from wars. And I believe I've been told that Trump is the only president that we've had in many, many years that hasn't started a new war, which I think is a pretty good thing, right? Some of the war, like Afghanistan, 19 years on, right? It's, I mean, ridiculous. I think it's only natural that some of those generals are going to be not like Trump and, Bolton and other people like that, right? And they're going to come out and say terrible things about Trump, some of which may be true or some of it may be at least directionally true. And some of it, I'm sure, is just them, trashing him because he's threatening their racket.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a great book called Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which I read a number of years ago, and it certainly gets into the military-industrial complex and a lot of the potentially corrupt. And I'll just use the word potentially, just because to stay in somewhat of a position of neutrality. Dynamics with the military and also with oil companies and building infrastructure projects in different foreign countries and in exchange for agreeing for military bases and some of that dependency that we've really created with oil around the world and whatever it is, 700 and some military bases around the world that we have that certainly have a dependency of protecting oil assets and billions of dollars that we invest per year in military just to protect the choke points, which is the crossings of where we're transporting oil from over there to over here. So there's no question about that there's a lot of dynamics there. The people that, I guess one of the challenges I have when I'm communicating with some of my, I would say less conscious Trump supporters or, engaging in some of those more heightened dialogues around criticisms around Trump is that my perspective has been that when there's such a long history of people or number of people either within the Republican Party, because it's easy to say, well, the Democrats are against them because they're Democrats and they're socialists and whatever else that they're going to say. But when there's Republicans, lifelong Republicans that have crossed the aisle that have said, and they've worked with him, that this guy's off the rocker and he's completely mentally unstable. He's only in it for himself. And there's no way I could support this man. That some people have a perspective that literally every single one of these people must be corrupt and they're the ones that are at fault and they have it out to get him and Trump is really the victim in every single one of these situations. That's a perspective that I've personally experienced in communicating and attempting to have a dialogue with people around that, or there's this dismissiveness to kind of pass that off as if it's not really Trump and it's because of, and then fill in the blank, whatever the because is, that it must not really be him. So Right. It's been challenging for me.
I totally understand that. I also think that there can be multiple reasons why people would, Republicans would come out and say that, that aren't Trump. And this is not me saying that it's not Trump, right? It can be like, there's no question that Trump's brand is toxic, due to a combination of his nature and the media coverage, right? Mm-hmm. And so do you really want to associate your brand as a politician with him, knowing that A, he might lose this election and he'll definitely not be president 4 years from now, right? Like four years and change, right? So how closely do you want to tie yourself to Trump? So that's a concern, right? Like, yes, like he might be threatening your racket in some way, right? You mentioned the word victim, right? Trump being a victim. That's one of the things that I think probably bother me the most about Trump is that he's very quick to play the victim card. And then he'll be like, the fake news and they attack me all the time. And it's okay, I can deal with it. I'm like, so he's like, victim, but I'm better than that kind of thing. It's like, and yet, like, he does stupid shit all the time that just creates problems for himself, right? And just, I mean, I'm just like, dude, just, that's where he's like grossly unconscious, right? Like, he just keeps tripping up in the same ways over and over again, and he doesn't seem to learn from it at all.
Yeah, exactly. That's, and it is, it's almost this, it's that reflex, right? That it's in the triggering mechanism. And once something gets triggered, even if it's perceived and not real that he's being attacked, he'll go back on the attack even harder and want to just bury someone. And then another thing that I've observed, and it's not because of what the media tells me, although of course I watch different, and I do my best to watch different sources of media to get a little bit of balance. But if I just pay attention to his Twitter feed and watch him speak, and his words that come out of his own mouth, that there is this igniting, and he could say one thing to one group of people when he's on script, and then when he gets off script at a rally, the things that he'll say to rile people up and to just fuel the energy from the people, he almost tells them what they want to hear. And the challenge is that with the level of anger and victim consciousness that he communicates with, that he's this victim, there are people, like he said, the only way he can lose the election is if he's cheated.
He hasn't said that though.
Oh, I think he literally said that word for word. I'll do my best to actually find that.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, what I've heard is like, if he loses fair and square, that's it. But he doesn't think that's going to happen because he sees the momentum in the country. But if he loses due to cheating, that's not okay.
Yeah. And so he has said the only way I can lose is if I'm cheated. And
right.
Then,
wait, well, that's, I hear that.
And then a couple days later, maybe then come back and say, well, if it's fair and square, but he said those words.
Right. But I hear that as saying, I am very confident in my chances. So the only way that I can see me losing, given what I know and our internal polling and the momentum that I see, is if there's cheating. I mean,
and I can appreciate conscious person being able to actually step back and filter through that and get the essence of what you believe he's actually attempting to say. And I'll suggest that there are very unconscious people that we have in our society. You know about the plot to kidnap and behead the governor of Michigan that just got unfoiled by the FBI a couple weeks ago. Are you aware?
I heard about that. I haven't looked into it, but what I heard about that was that it was an FBI basically goading people into it.
There were undercover agents that have been watching these groups of people that have been training and exploding IEDs in tests, and they had surveillance under her home that were planning on kidnapping and killing her. And this has been going on with other governors as well. And those same people, many of the same people that got arrested, were on the courthouse steps in Michigan just a few months prior. And Trump was tweeting and cheering them on and acknowledging them as good people. And saying very toxic. They were there protesting because they wanted their rights back, because they were feeling that they were being suppressed because the governor was shutting down the state because of the pandemic.
And so they were protesting the lockdowns. Yeah.
Yeah. They were protesting lockdowns with guns. They were showing up with heavily armed and doing that, and Trump supporting them and saying that the governor needs to be, I forget the exact words that he said, very toxic things, that it's all her fault. She's toxic. She's basically the enemy, and we need to remove her from office. So he speaks in these tones. And again, these are and I'm going to do my best to give him the benefit of the doubt that he's not consciously aware of how some people in our society might interpret that and the unintended consequences of those, of that level of vitriol and anger to speak in that way and to encourage these people. I believe that absolutely has a contributing factor to these type of plots that are playing out.
I hear you. But isn't that like, it seems to me that's happening even worse on the other side. Like, telling, Black people that they're oppressed in America, right? Telling, or indicating that it's okay to like riot and loot and burn shit down. Because you're justifiably angry. How many people have died during these riots this year, including Black people? Lots of Black people have died in those riots. Versus how many died, because of something Trump said, like these people. They were very peaceful in that demonstration, right? They may have had their guns, but they didn't use them.
Yeah. So I think that people have the ability to set a tone, like you and I. We're sitting here having a really peaceful conversation. I love it. And we can have differences in perspectives and opinions and hold an energetic field that's calm, that is, respectful and considerate. And we can agree to disagree, and we can banter back and forth and find common ground, which is beautiful. And I love the essence of your podcast and what you're ultimately attempting to be a way shower for other people. I think that that's phenomenal. And at the same time, if you have two people and one amplifies their voice and attempts to start attacking the other person, then the opposite person, the other person has an opportunity to engage at that level and go back again. And then it keeps escalating. It gets really, really bad. And I've seen I've seen fist fights break out in bars, and I've seen all kinds of things happen. I've seen companies deteriorate and collapse because of that type of dynamic when you get two powers like that. And at the same time, the other person, if they stay calm, they can navigate through that in a much greater way to minimize the escalation of conflict. And I would suggest that the president ultimately is accountable, no matter who the president is, because they're the president.
For what?
For the tone of our country and our political climate. And at the end of the day, they're accountable. And Trump oftentimes says that I'm not accountable and I take no responsibility at all. And, you know, John Wooden, go ahead.
For what is he saying that?
Oh, whether it's the pandemic that's in the way that things have played out in a lot of different ways. If I've witnessed him, Calvin, and I think anybody, if they go back and watch video footage of him over the last 4 years, if anything negative happens, he doesn't say, you know what, that's on me. I take responsibility that this is happening, and that's totally on me. And, you know, John Wooden is one of my favorite mentors as a basketball coach. You probably may or may not know him growing up in Denmark, but you know, he's just one of the people that says a strong leader accepts blame and gives credit. A weak leader gives the blame and accepts the credit. And Trump has that pattern of doing that. And that's a whole different conversation. But to go back to the situation in Michigan or where we're having violent riots that are taking place, there's no question that there's an opportunity for all people on the Democratic side and all neutral people to invite people into a place of calm and say, you know what, these riots need to stop and the looting and all that needs to stop. No question about that. And I will completely acknowledge that. I will say also, though, that there were groups that were involved in these riots, like the African-American police officer in Sacramento that was shot and killed. At first, it was blamed on or suspected that it was the Black Lives Matter rioters. And in fact, it was one of the Boogaloo Boys, who's a right wing extremist white supremacist group, that was actually the person that murdered that cop. So I think that.
Which cop was that? In what city was it? Did you say?
Sacramento, California. There was an African-American police officer that got shot and killed during the riots. And so I don't know who was really behind, much like your suspicion about the wars and the military generals and who, you know, what their real incentives or motives might be. I can say this, that the riots that have taken place with Black Lives Matter has probably been one of the best things for Trump's campaign, because he's used that as a rallying cry to get support and almost planted this level of fear that if Biden gets elected, then it's going to be socialism and communism. He's actually used the word communism that would come to America, and using Seattle, using Portland as this example of what will happen in a Biden presidency. And again, also saying it's the Democratic states that are at fault. It's the Democratic cities and Democratic leaders. And again, it just fuels this divisiveness that it's them that are the reason why our society is collapsing. And it's me that will be the one to save us. And I just don't see it that way. And I believe that that language pattern and way of communicating absolutely makes things worse. And it contributes to this divide that we have. And there's been no election in my life that I wasn't fully like, hey, if Bill Clinton wins, okay, fine. He's not my guy. If Al Gore wins, that's okay. And when Obama won, I fully embraced him, even though I didn't vote for him either time. But I just feel that Trump's predominantly responsible for that tone.
And so what do you see as, like, as Biden, what do you hope that a Biden presidency will do?
If you see, like, I guess the metaphor that comes to mind for me right now is a pop bottle that's all shook up with a bunch of this, like, pressure, and it's like this bomb that's about to explode, that the air can get let out just a little bit. I see that Biden has an experience and a history of working across the aisle with other people. And, you know, he's not with us anymore as he passed away, but John McCain was a huge fan of Joe Biden and would have absolutely supported him. I love the fact that McCain, by the way, almost chose Joe Lieberman as his running mate. And I believe that had he done that instead of, what's her name?
Sarah Palin.
Yeah, that he would have won the presidency. But just that willingness to even entertained the possibility of having a Democrat on the other ticket as your running mate was so weird. And I loved that about him. John Kasich, Mitt Romney, there's Republican leaders out there that are fully supporting a Biden presidency. And so I think it's like this, what I am hopeful for is there's a willingness to work across the aisle. And I believe that while some people can sit there and say that, what is it Trump said at the debate, that I've done more in 46 months than you've done in 46 years, and, you know, making like jabbing comments like that. But really and truly, the one thing I do see and perceive to be about Biden is that he is willing to work across the aisle. And I believe that any great government.
Do you feel like Trump is not willing to work across the aisle?
Yeah, I don't see it. I actually haven't seen him say a kind thing about any Democrat. And I've seen him not only say.
Have you seen Democrats say a kind thing about him?
No, not at all. I can't say that. And like I said, if we're going to go Mandela on this, or I can introduce Gandhi as well, that a great leader can take criticism and let that bounce off their back and then put that olive branch out. But I think that I would suggest that Trump's demeanor and his tone has unfortunately invited a level of criticism. And I think it's okay. And, you know, Biden said this in the town hall and the debate, and I may get the words completely wrong, but the essence of it was, it's okay to disagree with the person's judgment, but not their character, or question their judgment and not their character or their policies, and have a disagreement, just like you and I. But I'm not going to call you a name. But I can say, you know what, I really disagree with what you're saying right now. And you could say the same thing back with me, and I'd be like, cool. I mean, we can agree to disagree. Right. There's just this escalation that Trump takes it to a whole different nuclear level, as opposed to, you know, maybe the fighting that we would see before is fist fighting, and he's out here bringing out like nuclear type of energy in terms of just what I see from him.
Right. Yeah, there's no question. I'm trying to get my camera to focus.
That's all right.
He does that every once in a while. I think my big fear around Biden is, to me, America right now is in an existential struggle with China, and specifically the Chinese Communist Party, right? The country of China, the people of China are great, but the CCP, man, it's a nasty, like, mafia operation, doesn't even begin to describe it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Really nasty, bad, totalitarian regime. We know that they want to be the dominant superpower. They want to take over that role from America. Yeah. And Biden is in the pocket of the Chinese. I think that is, like, historically, he doesn't, you know, just on the surface level, like, he's been a supporter of, like, hey, you know, any development of China is good for America, like, very supportive throughout his career. But also, like, the Hunter Biden situation with him getting, what is it, $1.5 billion for a fund, you know, and some of that money is probably part of that. I think it's $16 million that Joe Biden has earned for himself over the past 4 years since he left the Obama administration. A lot of that is probably kickbacks from China, also other places, right? So that's my big concern, is that he comes in and, like, China is relentless. Like, give them 4 years of, you know, having the U.S. president essentially on the take, and they're going to exploit that to the max. And that might just be the 4 years that made the whole difference, right?
That's concerning. And I definitely am concerned about China for a number of different reasons. And I will acknowledge I don't know enough about the Biden involvement in China to give you an intelligent discourse back and forth to go into the depths of that. Other than the fact that I don't take anything on the surface of what's presented to me through any media source. And so I think that there's it's the complexity to that relationship is very deep. I don't believe that Trump has done a great job necessarily with China, but I do believe he attempted to. I will also acknowledge that Biden was not my first, second, third person favorite in the primary. We can talk about Mike Bloomberg another day, but I certainly appreciated his perspective and what he said about how to approach and how to negotiate with China. And digging yourself into a hole, and the, I guess, the erraticness that I see with Trump's negotiation tactics that may work in business to overpower someone, I see China looking at that as like a fool. And
you know, interesting.
Just real quickly, the thing about China too, and this goes back to Sun Tzu, they have a 500-year plan. They don't look right. at it as a 4-year plan even. And so—
No.
Yeah, and so that's the concern about them, is they don't have this turnover. And so when Trump is looking at, this is what I need for this next election, or this is what I'm gonna do right now, he's also looking at what's the GDP numbers and what do we do to facilitate growth? And they're just not looking at it that way. So it's a challenging situation because it's very volatile.
Right. What I see is Trump is the only one in the U.S. government who is, you know, seriously pushed back on China at all. Has he been successful? I think he's been, you know, he's been at least very successful in bringing it to the fore, right? And he has pushed back on things. And I think his erraticness can be actually be a very powerful negotiating strategy, right? Like, I think you have to take anything that he says not at face value. Like when he's saying like, hey, we're going to walk away from the negotiations with the Democrats over a relief bill until after the election or even after the inauguration or something, like that's not his final position. That's his opening bid in a negotiation, right? You have to realize that that's what he's doing. And yet he has to do it in public, and the public isn't smart enough to realize that in general. And so, you know, and then the media is going to run with it and say, like, he's crazy, he doesn't care about the people, when in reality he's negotiating, right? And I think some of the same things, like with the fact that he's so erratic, can be very powerful negotiating wise, because it's like, what the fuck is this guy willing to do, right? Like, tariffs are bad. Everybody agrees tariffs are bad. Boom, tariffs, right? Or like, you know, his like tweets with Kim Jong-un, like, you know, fire and fury, like the world has never seen, like, la, 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 right? Like, where it's like, okay, he's probably not going to do that, but he just might be crazy enough to actually do it. So it like gives that, you know, pause.
Yeah, look, I can agree that a very strong approach to China is important to take on. And I think we need to look at the long-term picture of that. The erraticness and the potential benefit of having someone in a volatile position, and certainly going to the Kim Jong-un thing and his behavior around that, I can't get behind that. I feel that there are, again, not just poor examples, but I feel that it's like in poker, someone being an easy tell. And I think that the perspective with Trump is he's a very easy tell. And he's very easy to pick apart because he's so predictable. And again, I don't believe that only him can be the one to fix it. And it needs to be a team of other people. And remember, I don't know if you remember this, when he first got elected, he built this board, and it was amazing. Like, he had Elon Musk and he had all these business leaders that were going to be in this huge thing, and they were going to come together and rebuild the economy and turn this thing around. And it fell apart so fast because no one could work with the guy. And there's this, I'm the one in control. I have the answers. I'm going to do this. And while I'll credit certain things, that there's some success he has and there's some benefit to having an independent thinking mind, I believe that any significant undertaking requires a team of experts that you lean on and rely on. And
you don't think he's doing that?
I don't. That's not my perspective of him at all. I don't. Yeah. And I mean, even as it relates to the COVID situation, that he implies he knows more than Fauci or the doctors, or it's going to all be done within a couple of weeks. And I know this. And now he actually has the cure for it with this medication. Not like a really good medication that's going to help a lot. It's like, it's the cure, using words like that.
I understand, but that's, I think, like, Trump uses language in a way that's different from most other people. I have a friend and therapist who's a genius body therapist, but linguistically he's not very evolved, right? So it's taken me quite a while, because like, I'm pretty advanced linguistically, so it's taken me a while to learn to understand his communication style. And Trump is the same way. What I appreciate about Trump is that directionally, he tends to be correct, and his gut instinct tends to be correct in terms of his the actual actions that he takes, right? Like his approach to Middle East peace. Let's not pretend like the Palestinian issue needs to be at the center of peace in the Middle East. We can completely rethink this in a way that no one else has ever done, right? North Korea, same kind of thing. Like he thinks differently, but you have to understand, you have to, like, you don't have to, but like in order to make sense of Trump, you have to realize that he does just use his language in a different way than you and I do.
Right. And that's the thing. So for me, policies, approaches, skill sets, I can look at, again, if I'm going back to who I'm going to hire for a company, I can see someone is brilliant that might have great talents and skill sets that could help a company grow in some ways, but their communication style is so reckless or toxic that it's going to have a negative impact. And so for me, when I consider the whole, and yes, his communication style is different. And yes, I perceive it to be incredibly toxic and harmful to our society and our culture. These are the reasons why I'm not supporting him. Not because I couldn't have a conversation if we were to really dive deep at all of the different policies he's taken and positions he's taken that I couldn't find a handful or maybe many that I would be like, yeah, that was a pretty good move. And this was a good choice or decision. But I could say the same thing about a great sales rep that's just toxic to the culture of a company.
Right.
So that's 100% where I'm coming from. Yeah.
I think that's very, very, very valid. Like, do you want to touch on the COVID thing again? Cause like, I think the COVID situation is such a good example of the fallibility of quote unquote experts and quote unquote science, right? Where, well, like just because you're an expert in, you know, epidemic diseases and whatnot, doesn't mean that you're an expert on policy, right? Like,
right.
You know, lockdowns might be great for killing the virus or stopping the virus. Doesn't seem like it, but it might be, like, if they were actually effective or we were actually able to do it, but they still might be terrible for the country, right?
100%. You know,
economy and suicides and, you know, drug overdoses and like long-term consequences to our psychology. And plus, like, I think it's reasonable to suspect that the rioting and all that stuff was fueled in large part by people being unemployed and stuck at home and isolated for months. Right.
Absolutely.
So I think there's that perspective, which, and then like the whole idea of science, like science, the whole point of science is that it's never settled, right?
No,
we never know anything really for sure. Cause there's always like a black swan. There's always the opportunity for new evidence and we should always be learning. So this idea that like follow the science, like when, you know, it's always evolving.
Right. Well, you do follow the science, understanding that the science always evolves. So it's like, it's not that what we know today, like the initial epidemiology models were projecting a much worse outcome. And then we had more cases, of course it evolved. So that definitely I agree with. And following science is what any logical, well-minded person would do if you're going to approach a situation. But again, I will acknowledge this, understanding that the science absolutely changes. But
two things on that. Like one, like modeling is not science, right? Models are models.
Correct.
And they can be a useful tool, but it's not science. The science is done by humans and it very easily becomes very political. I mean, the whole scientific paradigms, right, is, you know, there is this whole big peer pressure to hold on to, you know, certain ways of looking at things and confirmation bias and the peer pressure to like not, you know, speak out against what's correct, what's considered correct, et cetera, et cetera. Like, so science is deeply political as well. Didn't have to be, but it is in practice.
Yeah, like that's like thinking that gravity is political.
Gravity is political, but I mean, it's clearly like there's lots of interests, you know, in science, like, you know, funding and
who's funding and, you know, something. There's no question about that, and how the laws are set. And
if you go against the conventional wisdom, then like you're going to be harassed by all kinds of people who have their identity and their livelihoods tied up into conventional wisdom, right? There's going to be that pressure.
Yeah. And look, I certainly won't sit here and say that Trump's responsible for 200,000 deaths. People are going to die no matter what. There's no question about that. And what I will suggest is that the handling of COVID, from my perspective, he was notified on January 28th of
the Woodward interview.
Yeah, that there was no, the Woodward interview was February 3rd. January 28th was the meeting with the officials to say, hey, there's a serious problem. And for him to minimize that, even as recently as I think it was March 3rd, March 10th, he said, hey, there's only a handful of cases, 14 or whatever in the country, and within a couple of weeks, it's going to go away and there'll be nothing. And it's no different than the flu. It's definitely worse than the flu. It's not the plague, but it's much worse than the flu. And to minimize that on that level, and his reasoning was that I don't want to make people scared, I think is poor leadership at best. And I could say probably a lot of other descriptive words, because words matter and leadership matters. And he could have said, you know what, we have a serious problem right now, and I'm going to get the best people in the world behind this, and we're going to take care of it. But this is a serious virus, and we need to take this seriously. And it's important to listen to experts, and we're going to get behind this, but just to at least set the stage that there's a serious challenge. Now, I'll give him credit for closing down some travel from China. I don't think he stopped all travel, but there was some travel from China. And a lot of the biggest cases that came to New York were from Europe, and specifically Italy. So that was where a lot of the sourcing came from. So there was like this, let's blame it on China and call it the Chinese plague, and all of these different type of things, which just fuels more hatred. And none of that was necessary. Like, we have a pandemic, it's serious. And to say it's gonna go away in a couple of weeks and there's gonna be no cases, that was just either completely in denial or he's lying to the people consciously because he doesn't wanna scare them. And either way, I'm not okay with that.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you on, I think he could have handled that a lot better. I will say, I mean, it's worse than the flu for older people. It's a lot less bad than the flu for younger people, right? The flu is worse than COVID for younger people. Overall, is it worse than, it's definitely worse than the flu, like overall in terms of deaths, right? But to me, it seems pretty obvious now, and has been pretty obvious to me since essentially mid-March when I started talking about this, that like the only path here, because it's very contagious. Like, I think back in May, 25% of the New York City population had it, according to antibody, random antibody sampling. And then they stopped doing that, which that doesn't make any sense to me. But to me, the only practical solution here is protect the vulnerable and the elderly. Let everybody else go about their business as usual and catch it. And I think that's the only practical thing that we can do. We can't prevent all deaths. We've never tried to do that with any other thing in society, and we cannot. It's not possible. And I wish that he'd had the balls to say that and believe that. But I mean, we all got scared and terrified and like, hey, what's going on here, right?
Yeah, I think time will tell. You know, obviously we have another wave coming. It's the season, so to speak. If it models the flu season at all, we're going to have more spread, and we'll see where all this goes. But I certainly agree that taking care of the vulnerable is very important. And basic social distancing, or I think the terminology should have always been physical distancing instead of social, because again, to your point of all the different psychological and mental health issues that have been created from this. And then just basic things like wearing a mask. Like, there's no question that it helps to reduce the spread. And I'm all about that. I feel I'm not in fear whatsoever of whether I catch it or not. I hope I don't. And if I did, I'm not living in fear in that way. And I completely support wearing a mask. And, you know, even Chris Christie obviously was in ICU for 7 days, and he's not exactly
right. But he's, I mean, massively,
he's not a living example, right, of a great healthy body.
No, right. Right.
I'll say that.
Yeah, he's definitely someone that should in protecting himself, probably, right? I'm pretty sure I caught it back in early March. Had 4-3 days of fever, losses of smell, no cough, but you know, I haven't been sick in 10 years. So I'm kind of imagining it was that.
Yeah.
And I think it was the best thing that could happen. Like, catch it early, get it over with. Right.
Right.
You build immunity at least for a while. You can't spread it anymore. And just, yeah.
Yeah.
Like measles or something. Right. When I was a kid anyway.
But again, there's just this way of erraticness of him talking about it. Like, we can inject things into our body. And he probably was talking about ozone therapy, which I think is actually pretty good. But it's just like the words he chooses to use. And it's almost like he's making things up as he's talking. It's like, dude, shut up. And just,
no,
I mean, it's just like, I just can't imagine that. And it's so harmful. And it just like the erraticness and the impact that those words have on people. There's so much about that that it's hard for me to comprehend that a leader in a leadership position could speak that way and act that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, it's fascinating what someone with Trump's instincts, but not you know, different, much better communication style and could accomplish, right?
One of the leadership qualities and traits I love about people is like someone say, you know what? I don't know. I don't have the answer, but I'm gonna go find out. I'll find out. And you know what, man, I own that. I made a mistake. I really thought that this was going to work and it didn't. Like, I love it when people can just speak and lead from that perspective. And if anything, I have compassion for him. I haven't read his niece's book. But just understanding, you know, that she's a psychiatrist and the traits that she saw from him. And I'm not saying this to knock him. I actually, there's a part of me that I've felt this way for a long time about him. I have compassion for him. I see him as a scared person that feels that he has to defend himself, that feels attacked. And these triggers are from a deeply rooted wound that he has in his psyche on some level that's never been dealt with. And it's just matured into his adult life. But this tendency to just attack people that disagree with him and the toxicity that's associated with that is harmful.
It's funny because the conversation here was like, you know, why do you vote for Trump, Biden, right? And then the entire conversation ends up being about Trump, which I think is indicative, right? I think that is why most people vote for Biden, which is also why he's like doing everything he can to stay out of the news and out of the headlines, because he knows as long as Trump is out there yapping, and he's going to dig his own grave deeper and deeper.
Well, I'll say this. Here's a why Biden. And I believe this about him. I believe he's going to surround himself with teams of experts in different areas that he won't try to override and say that he knows more than them and bring people together. As I mentioned before, that there's this, I believe, a capacity to bring people together and work across the aisle that he has, that Trump has never displayed. And there are way more Republicans that are endorsing Biden than any presidential candidate has had endorsements from someone of the opposite party. One of my sites I go to is rvat.org, which is Republican Voters Against Trump. And there are hundreds of videos of just people like you and me, as well as prominent people like the Miles Taylors of the world that have been in staff positions that are sharing their personal stories of why they're voting for Joe Biden. And while I agree with you, there's no part of me that will sit here and say I agree with Biden on every single front. He wasn't my number one or number two candidate. But
who was your number one?
Mike Bloomberg.
Mm. And number two?
Pete Buttigieg.
Okay.
Yeah, I love Pete. If he had more experience, I really would have gotten behind him. I love his kindness. I think he could have undressed Trump a lot more, even with his how articulate that he is, because he doesn't really have that mean tonality and he's so articulate and intelligent anyway, and willing to honor people's perspective that have different beliefs.
Mm-hmm. So when I see Biden, I see someone that is very good at smiling and glad, silver tongued, I think is the term, right? So he keeps saying that he decided to run because of, you know, Trump supporting white supremacists in Charlottesville, which didn't happen, right? Like he said, there are good people on both sides of the statue question, and I condemn white supremacists you know, and neo-Nazis completely. Most people should be condemned completely. It's what he said. And yet Biden keeps trotting out that story, which he knows is a lie, but he also knows that it resonates with people and he doesn't have any problem with that.
I respectfully disagree on that one too. And it's okay. Trump did say that there's good people on both sides. Now, he did condemn white supremacy, but that's an example of talking out of two sides of his mouth from my perspective. You know, even when he was asked in the debate, are you willing to condemn hate groups and white supremacists? And his response was, Proud Boys, stand back and stand by. What was the term stand by intended to imply? And I'll say this, from the white supremacists and these groups of people, they fully think that Trump supports him. And he'll retweet them. And so it's almost like this, it's perceived as a wink, wink. Like, hey, of course I have to say, I'm not for you, but wink, wink. Let me retweet something that you put out or stand by. Like, I can't comprehend that if let's say it was Obama or even Biden for that matter, speaking to the Black Panthers or some other group of, you know, to say stand back and stand by, or you know what, there's some good people on this. I have a challenge with that for sure.
It's so interesting for me. So like for me, it was very clear. He's saying like, not all the people who are for that statue or white supremacists, there are good people on both sides, even though obviously the neo-Nazis and the white supremacists are bad people. Like he's been asked about this over and over and over again, more than any other president. And he's denounced them every single time. And I think the Proud Boys thing is like, you know, just sure, I'll condemn. Who do you want me to condemn? I'll condemn them. Great. And again, this is Trump's language. He's not like, oh, let me condemn them in a way that kind of sounds condemn-y, but not really. I mean, it's not how he operates in my mind. He's just like, yeah, I don't know the Proud Boys, whatever. Like, yeah, sure. If they're bad, I'll condemn them, right?
He retweets them. So he,
right, but does
he has a history of retweeting them and to say with this, this is
does where, he retweet as in like, oh, I've researched these people and I know who they are versus like, is that tweet saying something that he agrees with or that supports his case and then he's going to retweet them, right? He retweets pretty darn liberally. And I'm with you that.
He's retweeting the thing about bin Laden not really happening.
Right.
I mean, that to me is just absolutely insane. As a leader, how could you do that? You're the leader of the free world. You're the president of the United States. And you're retweeting an article that shares that the bin Laden capture never happened.
Well, that wasn't what it said.
And he said,
though, right?
And he said, I actually just want the people to decide for themselves. Oh, of course I know it's not real, but I'm going to share it anyway.
No.
You share it and people read it. They interpret that as, this must be true. It's coming from the president. He's sharing this because he's true. He didn't ad lib to say, hey, I'm just sharing this so you guys can decide for yourself whether this is true or not. He's retweeting it with the implication that he endorses that position or that conspiracy.
I mean, that's one way to look at it. I see him as retweeting it with the intention that he wants to give it, you know, more circulation, right? So that more people see it.
I give something that's a complete lie circulation. And where do we have a history?
Do we know that it's a lie? I'm just serious question. How would we know? What I saw that thing say was that bin Laden was held in Iran for a long time. And the whole Abbottabad thing was something that was orchestrated to give Obama a victory lap by killing him. Right. And that there's, I forget the details, but there was like things around that whole thing that were deeply suspect. And like, honestly, we know that the CIA, the NSA, the military, you know, black have done terrible, crazy stuff that we don't know about all over the world. Do we know that something fishy didn't happen in that case? I mean, I'm sure Osama bin Laden's dead, right? I have no reason to doubt that, right?
Yeah,
I think the reality is we don't know, right? A lot of shady shit happens.
Right. And so if you don't know something, then talk to some experts and do your own internal investigation to find out. But to share that in that context, or to not call out QAnon in his town hall. No, that's a
but why. Why should he call out QAnon? Why should he? Like, I mean, has Biden called out Antifa, or like, I mean, is it his job to call out anyone that people might disagree with that might like him, or like, I mean,
yeah, I personally see that group as a very, very, very harmful organization that is spreading a lot of lies and doing a lot of,
but it's not a group and it's not an organization though.
Okay. So,
I mean, it's not.
Okay. So what would you call it? What's your perspective on QAnon? Let's go there.
I'm
genuinely curious because I've seen some people, I mean, you know, certainly believe that that Hillary Clinton and the whole ring of pedophiles and kidnapping children and the Pizzagate, that there's a very specific group of people that within this movement that are believing these things and are sharing these things, and there are people within the government and Trump that will retweet QAnon conspiracies and to share these type of, and I will call them lies and things that are just absolutely, I mean, a guy went with an assault rifle to the pizza place in Washington, D.C. with the intention to shoot it up.
Right. There's one person that did something.
You know how many other people that, I mean, even that I'm connected with in my own life that believe these things, that are sharing these things on the walls. Like, it's just, and so to not speak out on that and by the way, if Biden's asked about Antifa, and by the way, they're not a group or an organization either. You know that, right? They're not an official group or organization.
I would say that they're way more organized than QAnon.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They have like uniforms and they travel around the country and cause trouble, right?
Would you consider yourself anti-fascist yourself, or are you pro-fascism?
I'm anti-fascist, but Antifa is a fascist organization. In my view, because they literally say like on their website, something like, if you, you know, basically, I forget what it was, but I looked it up, but I was like, you know, it's kind of the definition of fascism, right? They're hijacking language to make it seem that they're good people when they're terrible.
From my perspective though, if it's something like, if you're asking me, am I willing to call out someone on the left or the right that is doing either some type of harm or contributing to violence or more separation within our society, I'm going to say, absolutely, I'll call that out. So if Biden's asked that question and he denies it, and you can point to an example where he did, I'd be like, yeah, he's wrong for that. I'm not going to sit there and defend him.
Well, he said it was an idea and not an organization and didn't condemn Antifa, right?
Okay, then if he did, I would say, you know what? I totally don't agree with that. And I believe that whatever darker parts of that organization should certainly be called out. Now, if there's people that have genuine beliefs around anti-fascism and they want to go protest in a peaceful way, I can support that. Although I certainly personally don't agree with blocking streets and not giving access to people's homes and restaurants and doing harm for people. I think that there's a more peaceful way that does less of a harm to areas to protest. But, if he didn't call that out, didn't call violence out, I'd be like, yeah, he's wrong for that. And I totally don't support it. I wouldn't even hesitate. That's right. So Trump was really given that opportunity and he did hesitate. So I just feel that was a missed opportunity. And again, I think it's like, it's a way of playing to the audience, whether it's the,
it's so funny. I didn't see him hesitate for a second. I didn't see him like playing. He was just like, what do you want me to condemn? I'll condemn them again for the 100th time, 200th time. Like, I keep condemning them. And then you're like, oh, yeah, but you didn't quite really condemn. You were like hesitating a little bit. I didn't feel that you meant it in your heart. Like, they'll make something up to make it like not real. And like, he's like, dude, what the fuck am I supposed to do here? Like, what do you want?
Yeah, I think that I go back to, I grew up as a child here and Reagan was the president at the time. And I can see the strength and the way that he would have spoken to any of these groups, or George W. Bush or Clinton, and I can stay along the Republican lines. It's not about, I'm not partisan. I'm more Republican in many ways than I am Democrat, but I consider myself an independent. So I see a wink wink is what a lot of people perceive it to be when he condemns a group. and then later maybe either retweet them or reach out to them. Or I can certainly say this, for whatever reason, they think he's 100% behind him. So maybe they're just—
How do you know that?
I mean, they— I don't know. I guess I've seen some of their tweets, some of their YouTube videos. I mean, from the groups themselves, but—
Saying that Trump is behind them or that they're behind Trump?
Both. Absolutely. Especially the Proud Boys thing. That was like, that was almost like a badge of honor that they got. They felt like he was, you know.
Yeah, really they— I mean, they made a joke out of it, right? They ran with it. Which they all— I mean, nobody— I mean, I don't know. Like, I only heard about Proud Boys recently. Like, I mean, it was like—
I had never heard of who they are.
Tiny organization. And then like,
yeah, I mean, I never heard like, of them until
condemn
that
the Proud Boys. They're like, fuck yeah. I'll I'll condemn them. Right. Like, I mean, So it was a huge publicity boost for them, I'm sure.
Yeah, for sure.
I had
never heard of them.
Q— I mean, QAnon, just to answer that, I'm not a QAnon person or anything like that. I don't— I spend a little bit of time looking into it at one point, and like most of it is like very cryptic, like, you know, and then some Bible verses and some stuff, and I'm like, I don't know what to make of this, honestly. Well,
the essence of some of the people that I know think that there's this great awakening coming and he's been the chosen savior.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's almost like it's out there. And so I think that he probably is aware that people think that he's the savior in that group, and he doesn't want to alienate them. And, and it's like, it was almost like a rally cry to them in some way to not call that out. And again, I'm saddened when I see that. And when it comes to conspiracy theories, I mean, it's just a theory of a conspiracy, right? If you get arrested, you're arrested and you're charged with a conspiracy to commit. So then we get to do an investigation to find out whether that is valid or not. And so that term I'm indifferent about. And I think it's always a good idea to be willing and open-minded to look at different perspectives and challenges or sources of corruption that we have in our society. But the way with which we go about it is important to me. And that's— it's just challenging to see some of these organizations that are sharing things in a way that I perceive as doing more harm than good.
Yeah. I mean, that's how I look at Black Lives Matter. Right.
Yeah. I think it's unfortunate that, that there's this resistance to say Black Lives Matter. Because—
well, the only reason there's a resistance is that it's become a loaded term to mean the organization, which is, to my eyes, a very harmful organization.
Yeah, I don't know enough about the organization itself, so I cannot speak on their behalf.
I think it's like not wanting to buy into this victimhood story that like Black people are oppressed in this country in general, right? Which I think is a terrible thing to tell Black people. Like, the system is rigged against you and you don't have any chance. I mean, if you wanted to really, you know, make a population group suffer, convince them that they're victims and they have no chances, right?
Well, out of respect for the topic, I'll refrain from having a deeper dialogue about this. But other than the fact that I'll say that I do believe that systemic racism has been very deeply rooted within our society for a number of years. I think that we've come a long way, certainly from where we were a few hundred years ago, just giving people the ability to vote. But there are other things, and this is one of the things I loved about Mike Bloomberg in terms of just things that he has done things he's attempted to do to help the Black community out. And I do agree with you in the context that convincing anybody mentally and having that affirmation that they're a victim is not helping them out of a situation. But right. That also can come across as minimizing the fact that some people are in a place where they don't have as many opportunities as other people do. That are white or that live in different parts of the country. So sometimes it's not necessarily about race as much as it is the geographic locality where you live, access to certain schools, right, water, whatever. But again, that's something that, respectfully, if I had any of my Black friends or, you know, people within that community, I would rather them speak on their behalf. Sure. Other than the fact that I will say that you know, no question, I want to do everything I can to listen and to hold a space and support to end that, because I don't ever want anyone to perceive that that they're living in a world that has even the slightest ounce of racism. And the challenge that I think where things have gotten escalated, and I don't know enough about the Black Lives Matter organization itself, but the challenge that some of either the violent protests, some of the looting, rioting that's been assigned to them, and I'm not going to sit here and say that I know it to be true only because I don't, so I'm not going to say one way or another, that it has ignited this opposite side to say Black lives don't matter, or all lives.
Has anyone said that?
That all lives matter, the connotation or association to say that all lives matter is certainly received as Black lives don't matter, or, oh, this Black Lives Matter is so bad. And so the association that many people perceive when they're hearing that is to dismiss the essence of what maybe the organization was originally founded for, or at minimum, the African-American community is speaking out for, that they're not necessarily associating or aligning with what is perceived to be so negative about the organization itself at all, but they have challenges that they want to bring forth to have solved, and they have a conversation around systemic racism that they want to address that is being dismissed as no. And not saying that Black lives don't matter, but the movement of Black Lives Matter is bad. And I see when I turn on Fox News, like this dismissiveness of, oh, this Black Lives Matter. And it's talked about in a way that the entire movement and the entire concept of Black Lives Matter is dismissed and bad and corrupt and violent. And that may be the smallest percentage of the entire population of people that might align themselves with the concept of Black Lives Matter. But but the entire movement, if you will, is thrown out because of what is perceived to be a handful of people.
Well, I mean, I think it's because of the leadership and stated intentions and real world results from it. I think that's what causes people to push back against that, right? Not just a few like random people in the group, but
yeah. And so when I say Black Lives Matter, my African American friends and my white friends and my other race friends that support Black Lives Matter, I don't go to the website of that organization whatsoever at all. I couldn't tell you who the leader is. So for me, it's more the terminology that Black Lives Matter and the essence that, that there has been a challenge with systemic racism in our society for a number of years, not so, as an affirmation to plant into someone's consciousness that this is going to perpetuate and continue, but there are real conversations to have and opportunities to clean things up to support the African American community that I completely support. And my friends that are African American that I communicate with, that I'm aware of, and the my other friends that support Black Lives Matter, to my knowledge, I don't know if they know the leaders of the organization at all. They might. I don't know that, but from my experience, that's never been something I've talked about.
Okay.
And so I think it's unfortunate that it's turned into this politicized thing.
Well, I don't think it's turned into it. I think it was, you know, very intentional from the outset. But I'm curious about, like, so systemic racism, how do you define that? How do we measure that?
It's a great question. And again, it's a deeper conversation than I probably am equipped to have without pulling up data and knowing that this is what we're going to talk about. But if we look at the number of communities that were built, you know, and the redlining of districts in urban areas where loans weren't given, African Americans didn't have access to purchase homes. The greatest way that people earn equity and wealth in our society is through home ownership.
So we agree that those things are no longer legal, right? Those have all been stopped.
Understand. And when you look at place with which where people live and grow up, that sometimes it's multi-generational staying in similar areas or neighborhoods.
Sure.
That how do we help support home ownership, even having access to banks and building credit and all of that. So I'm not looking at this as a punitive type of thing. I'm looking at this as, and this is probably where I agreed, and it's unfortunate that Bloomberg had some of the negative stuff against him. And I think he was just more of a dry orator of his positions. And he was not a fun person to listen to because he's very dry and boring. But, a lot of the things he is still involved with, regardless of whether he became president or not, and will continue to do to help set up banks and loans and business opportunities to support African Americans and African American community, I think is very good. But so I think that there's just inherently, some of those structures that are in place that have contributed. So you're looking at today, the people that are growing up today may not have had the same level of access that I certainly did.
What I hear you saying is that there's let's call it institutional racism. Historically, there's been institutional, racism, redlining, segregation, even, those kind of things. And even though those things have all been outlawed now, history has consequences, right? History has consequences for today. Is there, aside from those issues, are you seeing systemic racism today?
Well, look, I'll say this, Kyle, but I'm not proud to admit it, but I grew up in the Midwest. And when I was 10, 12, African-American family moves into a local community near us and stakes are put in the yard. Okay.
Is that because they're black or because they're poor or just like,
no, there were racist people.
Got it.
I can't believe a black community moved into our neighborhood.
Or systemic racism? I would call it racism, but I wouldn't call it systemic. Systemic racism.
Yeah. Right. So then if we look at, whether it's people hired in leadership positions, if people have that within their spirit and within their being, that dictates the way that they hire, that dictates the way that they engage with people. I do believe that there's challenges. I think I don't know how we rid that out, the hate or the bigotry or the racism that individual people live with. And I think it's hopefully, I like to think it's way less than it's ever been, but I don't know. I just know in my heart, I don't think I've ever felt that way myself. But when I hear stories, or with police officers pulling people over, why are you in this neighborhood? Why are you driving this car? I've heard real stories from my African American friends that have shared that in recent years that they've had that happen to them. And it's so unfortunate. Excuse my dog in the background.
That's all right. Yeah. All right. No. Yeah. I mean, cause I've been thinking, I think a lot of this stuff is about class and not about race. Although, I mean, I'm certainly not disputing at all that racism exists, that racist people exists, but to me, if we're talking policy, right? If we want to make policies to address a problem, we need to be able to define clearly what that problem is and how to measure it so that we know if what we're doing makes it better or worse. Yeah. And I haven't seen a workable definition of quote unquote systemic racism, which I think is a big problem if we are serious about addressing it. To me, it's like the main thing is like, can we find out how to get better schools, right? So that we teach people from a young age and give them the skills that they have. Because I think the reality is for a lot of people, not everywhere, but in a lot of places, if you have a black person and a white person and an Asian person that are absolutely equally qualified, most companies these days would hire the black person, right? Because diversity, it's better. Like you get brownie points for the very unfortunate term to use, but it's a virtue, right? You get to show off like your diversity and all that stuff. And I think it's about how do we help, raise education. And I don't think it's a racial issue, really. I think it's more of a class thing, more of a problem with poverty. That's where I would start. Better schools.
I think the best way I can share how I feel is the saying to seek first to understand. That I think it's really important to have in our society today, and sitting with people that have been affected by anything, whether it's, you know, sex discrimination or race discrimination, or even the perception that that's happened to them, rather than having a defensive position or, you know, not being willing to just be present with someone to really listen. I think that that's what we need to have more of in our society and get to the root of it. So definitely agree, better schools, no question about that. And there's probably so many things that I'm not even close to being remotely aware of that I could never comprehend or pretend that my life and the way that I've grown up could understand what an African-American has gone through, or maybe a person just growing up in a different part of the country that might be of the same race. I don't know. But when someone says that they're feeling pain and that they've had experiences, I want to sit and be present as much as I possibly can to understand that, and to do what I can to help overcome that.
Yeah.
In any way that I can.
I'm 100% on board with that. And I would also say, like, you know, as a matter of policy and government, right, it's kind of limited what the government can do in that regard.
Education certainly is one. And I think that there, and again, that's something I don't even know what's being proposed, to be honest with you, in terms of either side of the aisle. Active outreach to help communities. Absolutely. No matter whether, I mean, just specific geographic areas, zip codes, parts of the country where there's higher levels of poverty and crime, to address that and fix that. I mean, there's certainly no question that we could get into violence and all kinds of other issues around that, but that would be longer than we have on our clock today.
Yeah. We're out of time officially. Yeah, We've gone like overtime by a bit here.
Yeah.
So let's find a nice way. Like, I love that we ended up with like probably the most contentious issue.
The heaviest, energetic like of all of them. And again, it's one of those things, not that I'm not willing to have conversation. It's just that with certain topics, I really would love to defer and hold space for people that feel that they're on the receiving end or the ones that are affected by it more so than me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah.
All right, Doug, like, final thoughts. What are your takeaways from this conversation?
Appreciate the ability to have the conversation, to have, you know, an understanding. I want there to be less division in our society, and I believe the path forward in this election is with Joe Biden. And I couldn't be more clear about that choice for myself. And, you know, could get into other people that I perceive in leadership positions and that I respect that also feel the same way. But the bigger thing is that when we come out of the election here in a couple of weeks, I just hope we can start a healing process, no matter who wins. But the tone is what's most important to me. And that's my biggest contributing factor as to why I'm making that choice for Joe Biden. And we're going to have a lot of healing either way, no matter who wins, because there's a whole group of people on opposite sides that if their side doesn't win, I can see how upset they might be. And I'm concerned about the ripple effect of what might play out. And so I hope there's more people like ourselves that are willing to be space holders and peacekeepers through this transition, and that we come out on the other side better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you, man. I really appreciate you being willing to show up for this. It's you know, not everybody's willing to engage and be honest and real in this way. So I really greatly appreciate that. I also still feel like you've formulated the best argument, most coherent argument, most sensible argument I've heard for Camp Biden. So really appreciate you. I
appreciate you as well. And it's just nice to know that we can not be enemies because we have different perspectives. And my gosh, I want more of that. That's the piece for me that, I wish you were here and you had a MAGA hat and I had a Biden hat together, because it's like with our arms around each other, because that it's okay to have different perspectives. We just need to pull this down and And so anyway, I appreciate the time for sure.
That's a good idea. We should like have that.
Yeah, I actually did. I ordered one of these things. I don't even know why, but I did order a Biden hat. So if you had a MAGA hat.
I do. Let me grab one here. Hold on one sec.
Misha, no.
All right. I got two, actually. I got my Trump 2020.
That's a better one. That's better than right. MAGA. By the way, I love that painting in the background. It's so good.
Yeah, America.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It refuses to focus on the Trump hat. I also have this.
I think that maybe there might be a reason why that is.
My camera is Team Biden. And yeah. I also got this one because it's just so over the top. It's so Trump. I'm going to have to do my thing again here.
It's blurry. There we go.
Fuck, it keeps doing it.
Well, you can find a screenshot in this, and what do you call that?
Trump, make America, and then a signature and USA. I mean, you can't, it doesn't get more.
What's that called when you, the placeholder image that you use for the video?
Oh, the thumbnail.
That could be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm like, sure, that picture is going to be all over the internet now.
Yeah, never mind. Yeah.
I was Team Democrat my whole adult life. And then I had like very mixed feelings around Trump during the election. Mm-hmm. But then after he got elected, I started to pay a lot more attention to politics and study and read. And like, I probably read 150 books on various political subjects, following a bunch of different sources that I would never follow before. Or listen to, deliberately seeking out information sources that I thought I would disagree with. And I found some really convincing arguments in it. Right. So, but there was like one, and then I started a live stream on YouTube daily, 5 days a week in early, like late winter of 2018. And I kept that up for a number of months. I forget how long exactly, which was my opportunity to really, think out loud and like talk about the issues. And there was a moment where I was just like, the coverage of this issue is just so one-sided that I was like, I'm going to fucking go to Trump Tower and buy a MAGA hat. So it was just a rebellious kind of thing. Like, fuck it. And then the more I paid attention, the more I became a fan, again, not of his style, not of his tone, but of his, radically different approach to solving some of these big intractable problems and his actual actions, right? His actual policies that he implemented that I think are have been very good, a lot of them. I don't know all of them, but
yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. No, it's I can respect, especially from a policy perspective, even though there's a number of things that I would disagree with, and we don't have time to go down the environmental conversation, but it's probably my deepest passion in this life, that I just genuinely want to leave this world better than I arrived. And I believe that we as a species are we're playing a significant role in contributing to our climate. And, but that's a whole different conversation. So if we want to have a follow-up part two,
let's do it. I'm game. I'd love to.
That's a scene. Yeah. Cause that's, okay. That's a whole other conversation. So anyway,
right.
Cool. Yeah. Well,
Team Trump, Team Biden. We'll do this again. We'll put on our dueling hats and then we'll,
even after the election, who knows? Like,
right.
Yeah. We could have like a little, I'd be willing to do that. After the election, whoever wins the election, the other person wears the hat.
Sure.
All right, cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
Done.
All right. All right. Okay. I appreciate the time. Wish you the very best, and we'll catch up offline sometime again. It's been good to reconnect with you.
It's been phenomenal. I really, really appreciate you, Doug. So great.
Likewise. Yep. Yep.
Thank you.
Wishing you the best. All right.
See you, man.
All right, cool.
Thank you for listening to the podcast episode. After 20 years as a serial entrepreneur, it's my passion to bring you ideas and insights from some of the best entrepreneurs, leaders, and thinkers in the world straight to your phone. We're going to be launching many, many more podcast episodes in the future, so please subscribe and leave a 5-star review if you found any value at all from today's conversation. Your reviews and feedback mean the world to me.